instructors and faith-based instructors. In fact, I still get a chill from reliving the fire and brimstone of some of the fear-based sermons I heard as a child. In contrast, I remember the uplifted feeling of hope and courage from the faith-based sermons. Hill's words of wisdom certainly ring true for me. Does fear then paralyze independent thought?
It seems that you go out of your way to keep people from thinking.
Yes. Accurate thought is death to me. I cannot exist in the minds of those who think accurately. I do not mind people thinking, as long as they think in terms of fear, discouragement, hopelessness, and destructiveness. When they begin to think in constructive terms of faith, courage, hope, and definiteness of purpose, they immediately become allies of my opposition and are therefore lost to me.
I'm beginning to understand how you gain control of the minds of children through the help of their parents and religious instructors, but I do not see how the school teachers help you in this damnable work.
School teachers help me gain control of the minds of children, not so much by what they teach the children, as because of what they do not teach them. The entire public school system is so administered that it helps my cause by teaching children almost everything except how to use their own minds and think independently. I live in fear that someday some courageous person will reverse the present system of school teaching and deal my cause a death blow by allowing the students to become the instructors, using those who now serve as teachers only as guides to help the children establish ways and means of developing their own minds from within. When that time comes, the school teachers will no longer belong to my staff.
Here is the essence of Hill's critique of public education, written in 1938. Do you agree with him? Think of young children during kindergarten and first grade. They are enthusiastic and volunteer for everything, raising their hands and excited to learn. Now fast forward 10 years and think about those same children as high school students, the ones sitting in the back of the class, never making eye contact with adults, and absolutely never volunteering or asking a question. They have disengaged from the learning process. What happened to these children? 10 years of schooling. They perceive that to make an error will subject them to ridicule and scorn. So they cease to participate in order to protect themselves. They are taught that the solutions to all problems and conflicts lie not in their own hands and minds, but in the hands and mind of the teacher, the representative of the authorities. To act independently in the face of conflict brings swift rebuke and reprisal from the teacher. The children are thus discouraged from independent thought and indoctrinated with the concept that they are incapable of resolving their own problems. While there are many excellent teachers, Hill's critique seems validated by the state of education today. If you agree with Hill, what do you think we can do about it? One thing we should do is seek out those teachers and schools who encourage independent thought in their students and applaud them for their courage.
I was under the impression that the purpose of all schooling was to help children to think.
That may be the purpose of schooling, but the system in most of the schools of the world does not carry out the purpose. School children are taught not to develop and use their own minds, but to adopt and use the thoughts of others. This sort of schooling destroys the capacity for independent thought, except in a few rare cases where the children rely so definitely upon their own willpower that they refuse to allow others to do their thinking. Accurate thought is the business of my opposition, not mine.
What relationship, if any, has your opposition with the homes, the churches, and the schools? Your reply to this question should be interesting.
Here is where I make use of some more of my clever tricks. I cause it to appear that everything done by the parents, the school teachers, and the religious instructors is being done by my opposition. This diverts attention from me while I manipulate the minds of the young. When religious instructors try to teach children the virtues of my opposition, they generally do so by frightening them with my name. That is all I ask of them. I kindle the flame of fear into proportions which destroy the child's power to think accurately. In the public schools, the teachers further my cause by keeping the children so busy cramming non-essential information into their minds, they have no opportunity to think accurately or to analyze correctly the things their instructors teach them.
Do you claim for your cause all those who are bound by the habit of drifting?
No. Drifting is only one of my tricks through which I take over the power of independent thought. Before a drifter becomes my permanent property, I must lead him on and ensnare him with another trick. I will tell you about this other trick after I finish describing my methods of converting people into drifters.
Do you mean you have a method by which you can cause people to drift so far away from self-determination that they can never save themselves?
Yes, a definite method, and it is so effective it never fails.
Do I understand you to claim your method is so powerful your opposition cannot reclaim those whom you have permanently ensnared through drifting?
I claim just that. Do you think I would control so many people if my opposition could prevent me? Nothing can stop me from controlling people except people themselves. Nothing can stop me except the power of accurate thought. People who think accurately do not drift on any subject. They recognize the power of their own minds. Moreover, they take over that power and yield it to no person or influence.
Go ahead and tell me more of the methods by which you cause people to drift to hell with you.
I cause people to drift on every subject through which I can control independent thought and action. Take the subject of health, for example. I cause most people to eat too much food, and the wrong sort of food. This leads to indigestion and destroys the power of accurate thought. If the public schools and the churches taught children more about proper eating, they would do my cause irreparable damage. Marriage. I cause men and women to drift into marriage without plan or purpose designed to convert the relationship into harmony. Here is one of my most effective methods of converting people into the habit of drifting. I cause married people to bicker and nag one another over money matters. I cause them to quarrel over the bringing up of their children. I engage them in unpleasant controversies over their intimate relationships and in disagreements over friends and social activities. I keep them so busy finding fault with one another that they never have time to do anything else long enough to break the habit of drifting. Occupation. I teach people to become drifters by causing them to drift out of school into the first job they can find, with no definite aim or purpose except to make a living. Through this trick, I keep millions of people in fear of poverty all their lives. Through this fear, I lead them slowly but surely onward until they reach the point beyond which no individual ever has broken the drifting habit. Savings. I cause people to spend freely and to save sparingly, or not at all, until I take complete control of them through their fear of poverty. Environment. I cause people to drift into inharmonious and unpleasant environments in the home, in their places of occupation, in their relationship with relatives and acquaintances, and to remain there until I claim them through the habit of drifting. Dominating thoughts. I cause people to drift into the habit of thinking negative thoughts. This leads to negative acts and involves people in controversies and fills their minds with fears, thus paving the way for me to enter and control their minds. When I move in, I do so by appealing to people through negative thoughts, which they believe to be their own. I plant the seeds of negative thought in the minds of people through the pulpit, the newspapers, the moving pictures, the radio, and all other popular methods of appeal to the mind. I cause people to allow me to do their thinking for them, because they are too lazy and too indifferent to think for themselves.
I conclude from what you say that drifting and procrastination are the same. Is that true?
Yes, that is correct. Any habit which causes one to procrastinate, to put off reaching a definite decision, leads to the habit of drifting.
I cause people to allow me to do their thinking for them, because they are too lazy and too indifferent to think for themselves. Laziness plus indifference equals procrastination equals drifting. This describes a true drifter as defined by Hill. Since I have been a true procrastinator for most of my life, this hits a little too close to home for me. I like to use the excuse that I work best under pressure, but that is all it is, an excuse for why I procrastinate. Can you think of examples in your own life when laziness and indifference led you off your path to success? When an opportunity slipped through your fingers because you were too slow to seize it in time.
Is man the only creature who drifts?
Yes. All other creatures move in response to definite laws of nature. Man alone defies nature's laws and drifts when he wills. Everything outside the minds of men is controlled by my opposition, by laws so definite that drifting is impossible. I control the minds of men solely because of their habit of drifting, which is only another way of saying that I control the minds of men only because they neglect or refuse to control and use their own minds.
This is getting to be pretty deep stuff for a mere human being. Let us get back to the discussion of something less abstract. Please, tell me how this drifting habit affects people in the everyday walks of life, and tell me in terms the average person can understand.
I would prefer to keep this interview up among the stars.
No doubt you would. That would save you from being exposed. But let us come back to Earth. Tell me now what drifting is doing to us as a nation here in the United States.
Frankly, I may as well tell you that I hate the United States as only the devil can hate.
That is interesting. What is the cause of this hatred?
The cause was born on July 4, 1776, when 56 men signed a document which destroyed my chances of controlling the nation. You know that document as the Declaration of Independence. Had it not been for the influence of that damnable document, I would now have a dictator running the country, and I would stop this right to free speech and independent thought that is threatening my rule on Earth.
Am I to understand from what you say that nations controlled by self-appointed dictators belong in your camp?
There are no self-appointed dictators. I appoint them all. Moreover, I manipulate them and direct them in their work. Nations run by my dictators know what they want and take it by force. Look what I have done through Mussolini in Italy. Look what I am doing through Hitler in Germany. Look what I am doing through Stalin in Russia. My dictators run those nations for me because the people have been subdued through the habit of drifting. My dictators do no drifting. That is why they rule for me the millions of people under their control.
What would happen if Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler turned traitors and disavowed you and your rule?
That will not happen because I have them too well bribed. I am paying each of them with a sop of his own vanity by making him believe he is acting on his own account. That is another trick of mine.
Let us come back to the United States and learn something of what you are doing to convert people into the habit of drifting.
Right now, I am paving the way for a dictatorship by sowing the seeds of fear and uncertainty in the minds of the people.
Through whom are you carrying on your work?
Mainly through the president. I am destroying his influence with the people by causing him to drift on the question of a working agreement between employers and their employees. If I can induce him to drift for another year, he will be so thoroughly discredited I can hand over the country to a dictator. If the president continues to drift, I will paralyze personal freedom in the United States just as I destroyed it in Spain, Italy, Germany, and England.
In 1938, when Hill was writing this manuscript, the president was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Are the devil's comments applicable today? Do you think Hill might write the same words today as he wrote 70 years ago?
What you say leads me to the conclusion that drifting is a weakness which inevitably ends in failure, whether among individuals or nations. Is that your claim?
Drifting is the most common cause of failure in every walk of life. I can control anyone whom I can induce to form the habit of drifting on any subject. The reason for this is twofold. First, the drifter is just so much putty in my hands, to be molded into whatever pattern I choose, because drifting destroys the power of individual initiative. Second, the drifter cannot get help from my opposition, because the opposition is not attracted to anything so soft and useless.
Is that why a few people are wealthy, while the majority of people are poor?
That is exactly the reason. Poverty, like physical illness, is a contagious disease. You find it always among the drifters, never among those who know what they want and are determined to get just that. It may mean something to you when I call your attention to the fact that the non-drifters, whom I do not control, and those who possess most of the wealth of the world, happen to be the same people.
I have always understood that money was the root of all evil, that the poor and the meek would inherit heaven, while the wealthy would pass into your hands. What have you to say of that claim?
Men who know how to get the material things of life generally know how to keep out of the hands of the devil as well. The ability to acquire things is contagious. Drifters acquire nothing except that which no one else wants. If more people had definite aims and stronger desires for material and spiritual riches, I would have fewer victims.
The actual verse of the Bible talks about the love of money, not money itself. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10.
I assume, from what you say, that you do not claim fellowship with the industrial leaders. Evidently, they are not friends of yours.
Friends of mine. I'll tell you what sort of friends of mine they are. They have belted the entire country with good roads, thus bringing into close communion the people of both city and country. They have converted ores into steel, with which they have built the skeletons of great skyscrapers. They have harnessed electrical power and converted it into 1,000 uses, all designed to give man time to think. They have provided through the automobile personal transportation to the humblest citizen, thus giving to everyone the freedom of travel. They have provided every home with instantaneous news of what is happening in all parts of the world through the aid of the radio.
And now television, smartphone, satellite, and internet.
They have reared libraries in every city, town, and hamlet, and have filled them with books, giving to all who read a complete outline of the most useful knowledge mankind has gathered from his experiences. They have given the humblest citizen the right to express his own opinion on any subject, at any time, anywhere, without fear of molestation. And they have seen to it that every citizen may help make his own laws, levy his own taxes, and manage his own country through the ballot. These are but some of the things the industrial leaders have done to give every citizen the privilege of becoming a non-drifter. Do you think these men have helped my cause?
Who are some of the present-day non-drifters over whom you have no control?
I have control over no non-drifter, present or past. I control the weak, not those who think for themselves.
Go ahead and describe a typical drifter. Give your description point by point so I can recognize a drifter when I see him.
The first thing you will notice about a drifter is his total lack of a major purpose in life. He will be conspicuous by his lack of self-confidence. He will never accomplish anything requiring thought and effort. He spends all he earns and more, too, if he can get credit. He will be sick or ailing from some real or imaginary cause, and calling to high heaven if he suffers the least physical pain. He will have little or no imagination. He will lack enthusiasm and initiative to begin anything he is not forced to undertake, and he will plainly express his weakness by taking the line of least resistance whenever he can do so. He will be ill-tempered and lacking in control over his emotions. His personality will be without magnetism, and it will not attract other people. He will have opinions on everything but accurate knowledge of nothing. He may be jack of all trades, but good at none. He will neglect to cooperate with those around him, even those on whom he must depend for food and shelter. He will make the same mistake over and over again, never profiting by failure. He will be narrow-minded and intolerant on all subjects, ready to crucify those who may disagree with him. He will expect everything of others, but be willing to give little or nothing in return. He may begin many things, but he will complete nothing. He will be loud in his condemnation of his government, but he will never tell you definitely how it can be improved. He will never reach decisions on anything if he can avoid it, and if he is forced to decide, he will reverse himself at the first opportunity. He will eat too much and exercise too little. He will take a drink of liquor if someone else will pay for it. He will gamble if he can do it on the cuff. He will criticize others who are succeeding in their chosen calling. In brief, the drifter will work harder to get out of thinking than most others work in earning a good living. He will tell a lie rather than admit his ignorance on any subject. If he works for others, he will criticize them to their backs and flatter them to their faces.
You have given me a graphic description of the drifter. Please now describe the non-drifter so that I may recognize him on sight.
The first sign of a non-drifter is this. He is always engaged in doing something definite, through some well-organized plan which is definite. He has a major goal in life toward which he is always working, and many minor goals, all of which lead toward his central scheme. The tone of his voice, the quickness of his step, the sparkle in his eyes, the quickness of his decisions clearly mark him as a person who knows exactly what he wants and is determined to get it, no matter how long it may take or what price he must pay. If you ask him questions, he gives you direct answers and never falls back on evasions or resorts to subterfuge. He extends many favors to others, but accepts favors sparingly or not at all. He will be found up front, whether he is playing a game or fighting a war. If he does not know the answers, he will say so, frankly. He has a good memory, never offers an alibi for his shortcomings. He never blames others for his mistakes, no matter if they deserve the blame. He used to be known as a go-getter, but in modern times he is called a go-giver. You will find him running the biggest business in town, living on the best street, driving the best automobile, and making his presence felt wherever he happens to be. He is an inspiration to all who come into contact with his mind. The major distinguishing feature of the non-drifter is this. He has a mind of his own and uses it for all purposes.
Can you think of someone you know who fits this description? Is that person a non-drifter?
Is the non-drifter born with some mental, physical, or spiritual advantage not available to the drifter?
No. The major difference between the drifter and the non-drifter is something equally available to both. It is simply the prerogative right of each to use his own mind and think for himself.
What brief message would you send to the typical drifter if you wished to cure him of this evil habit?
I would admonish him to wake up and give.
Give what?
Some form of service useful to as many people as possible.
So the non-drifter is supposed to give, is he?
Yes, if he expects to get. And he must give before he gets.
Some people doubt that you exist.
I wouldn't worry about that if I were you. Those who are ready to be converted from the habit of drifting will recognize the authenticity of this interview by its soundness of counsel. The others are not worth the trouble it would take to convert them.
Why do you not try to stop me from publishing this confession I'm wringing from you?
Because that would be the surest of all ways to guarantee you will publish it. I have a better plan than trying to suppress publication of my confession. I will urge you to go ahead with the publication, then sit back and watch you suffer when some of my faithful drifters begin to make things hot for you. I will not need to deny your story. My followers will do that for me. See if they don't.
Knowing that indeed this book was not published for more than 70 years after Hill wrote these words, I am intrigued and anxious to learn what else he will reveal. There are plenty of fireworks still ahead.
Chapter 5. The Confession Continues. If this confession of yours stopped right here, your statement would be sound. But fortunately for millions of your victims who will gain their release because of your confession, this interview will continue until you have supplied me with the weapon by which you will eventually be restrained from domination of people through their fears and superstitions. Remember, Your Majesty, your confession has just begun. After I wring from you a description of the methods by which you control people, I will force you also to give the formula by which your control can be broken at will. It is true I shall not remain here long enough to defeat you, but the published word I leave behind me will be deathless because it will consist of truth. You fear the opposition of no individual because you know it will be short, but you do fear truth. You fear truth and nothing else, for the reason it is slowly but definitely giving human beings freedom from all manner of fear. Without the weapon of fear, you would be helpless and entirely unable to control any human being. Is that true or false?
It is true I shall not remain here long enough to defeat you, but the published word I leave behind me will be deathless because it will consist of truth. Indeed, Napoleon Hill passed away in 1970. And this work, being published in 2011, becomes deathless.
I have no alternative but to admit that what you say is true.
Now that we understand each other, let us go ahead with your confession. But before we continue, I may as well take time out to do a little boasting on my own account, now that you have had your fling at it. I will confine myself to one question, the answer to which will give me all the satisfaction I want. Is it not true that you control only the minds of those who have allowed the drifting habit to be fixed upon them?
Yes, that is true. I have already admitted this truth in a dozen or more different ways. Why do you tantalize me by repeating the question?
There is power in repetition. I am forcing you to repeat the highlights of your confession in as many different ways as possible, so your victims may check this interview and determine its soundness by their own experiences with you. That is one of my little tricks. Do you approve of my method?
You couldn't be setting a trap for me for the purpose of doing some more boasting, could you?
I am asking the questions, and you are doing the answering. Go ahead now and confess why you are powerless to stop me from forcing this confession from you. I want your confession for aid and comfort to victims of yours whom I intend to release from your control the moment they read your confession.
I am powerless to influence or control you because you have found the secret approach to my kingdom. You know that I exist only in the minds of people who have fears. You know that I control only the drifters who neglect to use their own minds. You know that my hell is here on earth and not in the world that comes after death. And you know also that drifters supply all the fire I use in my hell. You know that I am a principle or form of energy which expresses the negative side of matter and energy, and that I am not a person with a forked tongue and a spiked tail. You have become my master because you have mastered all your fears. Lastly, you know that you can release all of my earthbound victims whom you contact, and this definite knowledge is the blow with which you will deal me the greatest damage. I cannot control you because you have discovered your own mind and you have taken charge of it. There now, Mr. Earthbound, that confession should feed your vanity to the bursting point.
That last dart was unnecessary. Knowledge of the sort I have used to master you does not contaminate itself with vulgar indulgence and vanity. Truth is the one and only thing in the world that can stand ridicule. Now let us continue with your confession. What is wrong with the principle of flattery? You use it, do you not?
Do I use it? Man alive, flattery is one of my most useful weapons. With this deadly instrument, I slay the big ones and the little ones.
Your admission interests me. Go ahead now and tell me how you make use of flattery.
I make use of it in so many ways it is difficult to know where to begin. I warn you, before I answer in detail, that publishing my answers will bring down an avalanche of ridicule on your head for bringing up the question.
I'll take the responsibility. Proceed.
Well, I may as well here admit that you have stumbled onto the major secret of how I convert people to the habit of drifting.
That is a startling admission. Go ahead with your confession and stick strictly to this subject of flattery. No more side remarks and no more facetiousness for the present. Tell me all about your use of flattery in gaining control over people.
Flattery is a bait of incomparable value to all who wish to gain control over others. It has powerful pulling qualities because it operates through two of the most common human weaknesses, vanity and egotism. There is a certain amount of vanity and egotism in everyone. In some people, these qualities are so pronounced, they literally serve as a rope by which one may be bound. The best of all ropes is flattery. Flattery is the chief bait through which men seduce women. Sometimes, in fact, frequently, women use the same bait to gain control of men, especially men who cannot be mastered through sex appeal. I teach its use to both men and women. Flattery is the chief bait with which my agents weave their way into the confidence of people from whom they procure information needed to carry on warfare. Wherever anyone stops to feed his vanity on flattery, I move in and begin to build another drifter. Non-drifters are not easily flattered. I inspire people to use flattery in every human relationship where its use is possible, because those who are influenced by it become easy victims of the drifting habit.
Can you control anyone who is amenable to flattery?
Very easily. As I have already told you, flattery is of major importance in alluring people into the habit of drifting.
At what age are people most susceptible to flattery?
Age has nothing to do with one's susceptibility to flattery. People respond to it in one way or another from the time they become conscious of their own existence until they die.
Through what motive can women be most easily flattered?
Their vanity. Tell a woman she is pretty or that she wears clothes well.
What motive is most effective in harpooning men?
Egotism, with a capital E. Tell a man he has a strong Herculean body or that he is a great business tycoon, and he will purr like a cat and smile like an opossum. After that, you know what happens.
Are all men like that?
Oh, no. 2 out of every 100 have their egotism so thoroughly under control that even an expert flatterer couldn't get under their skins with a double-edged butcher knife.
How does a cunning woman apply her art of flattery in attracting men?
Great heavens, man, do I have to draw a picture of her method for you? Have you no imagination?
Oh, yes, I have imagination enough, Your Majesty. But I'm thinking of the poor dupes of the world who need to understand the exact technique with which they may be flattered into the habit of drifting. Go on and tell us how a woman can harpoon rich and presumably smart men.
This is a devilish trick to play on women, but since you demand the information, I am helpless to withhold it. Women influence men through a technique consisting first of ability to inject soft, cooing baby tones into their voices, and second, by closing their eyes into a half-closed position, which registers hypnotism in connection with the flattery of men.
I am sure there are a few women agitated by this. In fact, I was at first. Roll your eyes and keep going. There is truth here.
Is that all there is to the business of flattery?
No, that is only the technique. Then comes the motive a woman uses as a lure. The type of woman you perhaps have in mind never sells a man herself or anything she can give him. Instead, she sells him his own egotism.
Is that all that women use when they wish to flatter men?
That is the most effective thing they use. It works when sex appeal fails.
So I am to believe that big, strong, smart men can be wound up and manipulated through flattery just as if they were so much putty? Is that possible?
Is it possible? It is happening every minute of the day. Moreover, unless they are non-drifters, the bigger they come, the harder they fall when the expert flatterer moves in on them.
Tell me of some of your other tricks with which you cause people to drift in life.
One of my most effective devices is failure. The majority of people begin to drift as soon as they meet with opposition, and not one out of 10,000 will keep on trying after failing two or three times.
So it is your business to induce people to fail whenever you can. Is that correct?
You have it right. Failure breaks down one's morale, destroys self-confidence, subdues enthusiasm, dulls imagination, and drives away definiteness of purpose. Without these qualities, no one can permanently succeed in any undertaking. The world has produced thousands of inventors with ability superior to that of the late Thomas A. Edison. But these men have never been heard of, while the name of Edison will go marching on, because Edison converted failure into a stepping stone to achievement, while the others used it as an alibi for not producing results.
Is the capacity to surmount failure without being discouraged one of Henry Ford's chief assets?
Yes, and this same quality is the chief asset of every man who attains outstanding success in any calling.
In the book 3 Feet from Gold, my co-author and I interviewed more than 35 of today's top leaders, not about their successes, but about their toughest moments and how they persevered to achieve great success. For example, Julie Crone, the first woman ever inducted into the Thoroughbred Hall of Fame with 3,704 victories under her reins, described her struggles at the beginning of her career as a jockey. Many of the horse owners simply would not hire a woman jockey. She said her motto of perseverance was, "Keep showing up." She said, "I discovered if I showed up every day and did my best, eventually they'd put me on a horse just to get rid of me." The rest is history. Julie was named as one of the toughest athletes of all time by USA Today. Her motto is a helpful reminder to all of us. Just keep showing up.
That statement covers lots of territory, Your Majesty. Do you not wish to modify it or tone it down a bit for the sake of accuracy?
No modification is necessary, because the claim is none too broad. Search accurately into the lives of men and women who achieve enduring success, and you will find, without exception, that their success has been in exact proportion to the extent that they surmounted failure. The life of every successful person loudly acclaims that which every true philosopher knows. Every failure brings with it the seed of an equivalent success. But the seed will not germinate and grow under the influence of a drifter. It springs to life only when it is in the hands of one who recognizes that most failures are only temporary defeat, and who never, under any circumstances, accepts defeat as an excuse for drifting.
If I understand you correctly, you claim there is virtue in failure. That does not seem reasonable. Why do you try to induce people to fail if there is virtue in failure?
There is no inconsistency in my claims. The appearance of inconsistency is due to your lack of understanding. Failure is a virtue only when it does not lead one to quit trying and begin drifting. I induce as many people as I can to fail as often as possible, for the reason that not one out of 10,000 will keep on trying after failing two or three times. I am not concerned about the few who convert failures into stepping stones, because they belong to my opposition anyway. They are the non-drifters, and therefore they are beyond my reach.
Your explanation clears up the matter.
Edison converted failure into a stepping stone to achievement, while the others used it as an alibi for not producing results. How are you dealing with failure in your life?
Now, go ahead and tell me of some of your other tricks with which you allure people into drifting.
One of my most effective tricks is known to you as propaganda. This is the instrument of greatest value to me in setting people to murdering one another under the guise of war. The cleverness of this trick consists mainly of the subtlety with which I use it. I mix propaganda with the news of the world. I have it taught in public and private schools. I see that it finds its way into the pulpit. I color moving pictures with it. I see that it enters every home where there is a radio. I inject it into billboard, newspaper, and radio advertising. I spread it in every place of business where people work. I use it to fill the divorce courts, and I make it serve to destroy business and industry. It is my chief instrument for starting runs on banks. My propagandists cover the world so thoroughly that I can start epidemics of disease, turn loose the dogs of war, or throw business into a panic at will.
If you can do all that you claim with propaganda, it is little wonder that we have wars and business depressions. Give me a simple description of what you mean by the term propaganda. Just what is it, and how does it work? I wish to know particularly how you cause people to drift through the use of this devilish device.
Propaganda is any device, plan, or method by which people can be influenced without knowing that they are being influenced, or the source of the influence. Propaganda is used in business for the purpose of discouraging competition. Employers use it to gain advantage over their employees. The employees retaliate by using it to gain advantage over their employers. In fact, it is used so universally and through such a smooth and beautiful streamlined technique that it looks harmless even when it is detected.
I suppose some of your boys are now engaged in preparing the minds of the American people to drift into some form of dictatorship. Tell me how they work.
Yes. Millions of my boys are preparing Americans to become Hitlerized. My best boys are working through politics and labor organization. We intend to take over the country with ballots instead of bullets. Americans are so sensitive they would never stand the shock of seeing their former government changed with the aid of machine guns and tank cars. So our propaganda boys are serving them a diet they will swallow by stirring up strife between employers and employees and turning the government against business and industry. When propaganda has done its work thoroughly, one of my boys will move in as dictator, and the 9 old men on your Supreme Court with their silly notions of the Constitution will move out. Everyone will be given a job or fed from the government treasury. When men's bellies are filled, they drift freely with one who does the filling. Hungry men get out from under control.
In 1938, one of the devil's tools for Hitlerizing America was turning the government against business and industry and feeding the populace from the government treasury. Is that still the case today? Is the devil succeeding? Were Napoleon Hill to interview the devil today, the devil might well gloat over the so-called entitlement programs now in place or proposed, and crow over the government's increasing involvement in independent businesses such as the automotive and financial industries.
I have often wondered who invented the clever trick which you call propaganda. From what you tell me of its source and nature, I understand why it is so deadly. Only one as clever as Your Majesty could have invented such a device with which to dull the reason, dethrone the will, and lure men into drifting. Why do you not use your powerful propaganda to gain control of your victims, instead of subduing them through fear and annihilating them through warfare?
What is fear of the devil except propaganda? You have not observed my technique very carefully, or you would have seen that I am the world's greatest propagandist. I never attain an end by direct, open means, which I can achieve through subterfuge and subtlety. What do you suppose I am using when I plant negative ideas in the minds of men and gain control of them through what they believe to be their own ideas? What would you call that, except the cleverest of all forms of propaganda?
Surely you are not going to tell me that you destroy people through their own help without their realizing what you are doing.
That is exactly what I wish you to understand. Moreover, I will show you exactly how the trick is performed.
Now we are getting somewhere. Exactly how do you convert human beings into propagandists and lure them into self-imprisonment? Give me the story with all its lurid details. This is the most important part of your confession, and I'm consumed with eagerness to gain control of your secret. I can hardly blame you for stalling about answering my question, because you know so well that your answer will snatch millions of innocent victims from your control. You also know that your answer will protect other countless millions of yet unborn people from being victimized by you. It is little wonder you are hedging about answering.
Your deductions are correct. This part of my confession will do me more damage than all the remainder of it.
Stating your headache in a better way, this part of your confession will save more millions of people from your control than all the remainder of it.
All I can say is that you have me in a hell of a situation.
Now you shall know how the millions of your victims feel. Let's have it.
I make my first entry into an individual's mind by bribing him.
What do you use as a bribe?
I use many things, all of them pleasant things the individual covets. I use the same sort of bribes that individuals use when they bribe one another. That is, I use for bribes the things people most want. My best bribes are these: love, the thirst for sex expression, covetousness for money, the obsessive desire to gain something for nothing, gambling, vanity in women, egotism in men, desire to be the master of others, desire for intoxicants and narcotics, desire for self-expression through words and deeds, desire to imitate others, desire for the perpetuation of life after death, desire to be a hero or heroine, desire for physical food.
In today's environment, clearly both women and men can fall victim to both vanity and egotism. Can you think of some examples?
That is an imposing list of bribes, Your Majesty. Do you use others?
Yes, plenty of them, but these are my favorites. Through some combination of them, I can enter the mind of any human being at will at any age from birth until death.
You mean that these bribes are the keys with which you can silently unlock the door to any mind you choose?
That is exactly what I mean, and I can do it too.
What happens when you enter the mind of a person who is not yet in the habit of drifting, but belongs in the 98% class as a potential drifter?
I go to work immediately to occupy as much of that person's mind as I can master. If the individual's greatest weakness is the desire for money, I begin to dangle coins before him, figuratively speaking. I intensify his desire and induce him to go after money. Then, when he gets near it, I snatch it away from him. This is an old trick of mine. After the trick has been repeated a few times, the poor fellow gives in and quits. Then I take over a little more space in his mind and fill it with the fear of poverty. That is one of my best mind fillers.
Yes, I admit your method is very clever, but what happens if the victim fools you and gets his hands on a lot of money? You don't fill his mind with a fear of poverty then, do you?
No, I don't. I take over the space by filling it with something which serves my purpose just as well. If the victim converts his desire for money into large sums, I start overfeeding him with the things he can buy with it. For example, I cause him to stuff himself with rich foods. This slows down his thinking capacity, endangers his heart, and starts him on the road to drifting. Then I pester him with intestinal poisoning through the surplus food he eats. That also slows down his thinking and gives him a nasty disposition.
What if the victim is not a glutton? What other follies can you induce him to pick up that lead to drifting?
If the victim is a male, I can usually snare him through his sex appetite. Overindulgence in sex starts more men to drifting toward failure than all other causes combined.
So food and sex are two of your surefire baits, is that correct?
Yes. With these two lures, I can take over a majority of my victims. And then there is the desire for money.
I'm beginning to think that wealth is more dangerous than poverty, if your story is to be believed.
That altogether depends on who has the wealth and how it was acquired.
What has the manner in which money is acquired to do with its being a blessing or a curse?
Everything. If you don't believe me, take a look at those who acquire a large amount of money quickly, without time to get wisdom along with it, and observe how they use it. Why do you suppose rich men's sons seldom equal the achievements of their fathers? I'll tell you why. It is because they have been deprived of the self-discipline which comes from being forced to work. Look into the records of moving picture stars or athletes who suddenly find themselves in possession of big money and hero worship and praise from the public. Observe how quickly I move in and take them over in many cases, mainly through sex, gambling, food, and liquor. With these, I catch and control the biggest and the best of people as soon as they get their hands on big money.
Think of the countless athletes who have become mega celebrities only to crash and burn from their fast money and fame. And then think of the millions of young people who looked up to them. Think of lottery winners who end up losing all their money within just a few years after they win the lottery. Could it be from drifting? A fallout from gambling? Could these cycles be orchestrated by the devil?
What about those who acquire money slowly by rendering some form of useful service? Are they easily snared too?
Oh, I get them all right, but I generally have to change my bait. Some of them want one thing and others want something else. Where my purpose is best served, I see to it that they get what they want most, but I manage to wrap in the package something they don't want. The thing I give them is the definite thing that makes them drifters. Do you see how I work?
And very clever work it is. You lure people on through their natural desires, but you slip your deadly poison into the object of those desires wherever you can.
Now you are catching on. You see, I play both ends against the middle, so to speak.
From all you say, I infer that you cannot induce a non-drifter to help you gain control of his mind by baiting him with your bribes. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. I can, and I do, interest non-drifters in my bribes, because I use for the purpose of bribery the things all people naturally desire. But the non-drifter resembles a fish that steals the bait from your hook, but refuses to take the hook. The non-drifter takes from life whatever he wants, but he takes it on his own terms. The drifter takes whatever he can get, but he takes what he gets on my terms. Stating the matter in another way, the non-drifter borrows money from a legitimate banker if he wants it, and pays a legitimate rate of interest. The drifter goes to the pawn shop, hawks his watch, and pays a suicidal rate of interest for his loan.
So I draw from your claims the conclusion that your hand is mixed up somehow in all of people's troubles and miseries, even though your presence may not be visible.
My unwilling workers are often my best workers. You see, my unwilling workers are those whom I cannot control with some combination of bribes, people whom I have to master by fear or through some form of misfortune. They do not wish to serve me, but they cannot avoid it because they are eternally bound to me by the habit of drifting.
Now I am beginning to better understand your technique. You bribe your victims through their natural desires and lead them astray while you induce them to become drifters if they respond to your lure. If they refuse to respond, you plant the seed of fear in their minds or trap them through some form of misfortune and hogtie them while they are down. Is that your method?
That is exactly the way I work. Clever, don't you think?
Which do you prefer to serve as your propagandists, the young or the old?
The young, of course. They can be influenced by most bribes more easily than people of mature judgment. Moreover, they have longer to remain in my service.
Your Majesty has given me a clear description of drifting. Tell me what must be done to ensure against the habit of drifting. I want a complete formula that anyone can use.
Protection against drifting lies within easy reach of every human being who has a normal body and a sound mind. The self-defense can be applied through these simple methods. 1. Do your own thinking on all occasions. The fact that human beings are given complete control over nothing save the power to think their own thoughts is laden with significance. 2. Decide definitely what you want from life, then create a plan for attaining it, and be willing to sacrifice everything else if necessary, rather than accept permanent defeat. 3. Analyze temporary defeat, no matter of what nature or cause, and extract from it the seed of an equivalent advantage. 4. Be willing to render useful service equivalent to the value of all material things you demand of life, and render the service first. 5. Recognize that your brain is a receiving set that can be attuned to receive communications from the universal storehouse of infinite intelligence to help you transmute your desires into their physical equivalent. 6. Recognize that your greatest asset is time, the only thing except the power of thought which you own outright, and the one thing which can be shaped into whatever material things you want. Budget your time so none of it is wasted. 7. Recognize the truth that fear generally is a filler with which the devil occupies the unused portion of your mind. that it is only a state of mind which you can control by filling the space it occupies with faith in your ability to make life provide you with whatever you demand of it. 8. When you pray, do not beg. Demand what you want, and insist upon getting exactly that with no substitutes. 9. Recognize that life is a cruel taskmaster, and that either you master it or it masters you. There is no halfway or compromising point. Never accept from life anything you do not want. If that which you do not want is temporarily forced upon you, you can refuse, in your own mind, to accept it, and it will make way for the thing you do want. 10. Lastly, remember that your dominating thoughts attract, through a definite law of nature, by the shortest and most convenient route, their physical counterpart. Be careful what thoughts you dwell upon.
That list looks imposing. Give me a simple formula, combining all the 10 points. If you had to combine all 10 in one, what would it be?
Be definite in everything you do and never leave unfinished thoughts in the mind. Form the habit of reaching definite decisions on all subjects.
Can the habit of drifting be broken, or does it become permanent once it has been formed?
The habit can be broken if the victim has enough willpower, providing it is done in time. There is a point beyond which the habit can never be broken. Beyond that point, the victim is mine. He resembles a fly that has been caught in a spider's web. He may struggle, but he cannot get out. Each move he makes entangles him more securely. The web in which I entangle my victims permanently is a law of nature not yet isolated by or understood by men of science.
Chapter 6. Hypnotic Rhythm. What is this mysterious law through which you take permanent control of people's bodies, even before you take over their souls? The whole world will want to know more about this law and how it operates.
It will be hard to describe the law so you will understand it, but you may call it hypnotic rhythm. It is the same law through which people can be hypnotized.
So you have the power to use the laws of nature as a web in which you bind your victims in eternal control. Is that your claim?
That is not only my claim, it is the truth. I take over their minds and bodies even before they die whenever I can lure them or frighten them into hypnotic rhythm.
What is hypnotic rhythm? How do you use it to gain permanent mastery over human beings?
I will have to go back into time and space and give you a brief, elementary description of how nature uses hypnotic rhythm. Otherwise, you will not be able to understand my description of how I use this universal law to control human beings.
Go ahead, but keep your story confined to simple illustrations which come within the range of my own experience and knowledge of natural laws.
Very well. I shall do my best. You, of course, know that nature maintains a perfect balance between all the elements and all the energy in the universe. You can see that the stars and the planets move with perfect precision, each one keeping its own place in time and space. You can see that the seasons of the year come and go with perfect regularity. You can see that an oak tree grows from an acorn, and a pine grows from the seed of its ancestor. An acorn never produces a pine, and a pine seed never produces an oak. These are simple things which anyone can understand. What one cannot see is the universal law through which nature maintains perfect balance throughout the myriad of universes. You, earthbound, caught a fragmentary glimpse of this great universal law when Newton discovered that it holds your earth in its position and causes all material objects to be attracted toward the center of the earth. He called the law gravitation. But he did not go far enough in his study of the law. If he had, he would have discovered that the same law which holds your earth in position and helps nature maintain a perfect balance over the four dimensions, in which all matter and energy are contained, is the web in which I entangle and control the minds of human beings.
Tell me more of this astounding law of hypnotic rhythm.
As I have already stated, there is a universal form of energy with which nature keeps a perfect balance between all matter and energy. She makes specialized use of this universal building material by breaking it up into different wavelengths. The breaking up process is carried on through habit. You will better understand what I am trying to convey if I compare it with the method by which one learns to play music. At first, the notes are memorized in the mind. Then they are related to one another through melody and rhythm. By repetition, the melody and rhythm become fixed in the mind. Observe how relentlessly the musician must repeat a tune before he masters it. Through repetition, the musical notes blend, and then you have music. Any impulse of thought that the mind repeats over and over through habit forms an organized rhythm. Undesirable habits can be broken. They must be broken before they assume the proportions of rhythm. Are you following me?
Yes.
Well, to continue, rhythm is the last stage of habit. Any thought or physical movement which is repeated over and over through the principle of habit finally reaches the proportion of rhythm. Then the habit cannot be broken, because nature takes it over and makes it permanent. It is something like a whirlpool in water. An object may keep floating indefinitely unless it is caught in a whirlpool. Then it is carried round and round, but it cannot escape. The energy with which people think may be compared with water in a river.
So this is the way in which you take control of the minds of people, is it?
Yes. All I have to do to gain control over any mind is to induce its owner to drift.
Am I to understand that the habit of drifting is the major danger through which people lose their prerogative or privilege of thinking their own thoughts and shaping their own earthly destinations?
That and much more. Drifting is also the habit through which I take over their souls after they give up their physical bodies.
Then the only way a human being can be saved from eternal annihilation is by maintaining control over his own mind while he is on this earth. Is that true?
You have stated the truth perfectly. Those who control and use their minds escape my web. I get all the others as naturally as the sun sets in the west.
Is that all there is to the business of being saved from eternal annihilation? Doesn't what you call your opposition have anything to do with saving people?
I can see that you do think very deeply. My opposition, the power you earthbound call God, has everything to do with the salvation of people from eternal annihilation. And for that reason, it is my opposition who provides every human being with the privilege of using his own mind. If you use that power by maintaining control over your own mind, you become a part of it when you give up your physical body. If you neglect to use it, then I have the privilege of taking advantage of the neglect through the law of hypnotic rhythm.
How much of a person do you take over when you gain control of him?
Everything that is left after he ceases to control and use his own mind.
In other words, when you gain control of a person, you take over all there is of his individuality up to the time that he quits using his own mind. Is that correct?
That is how I operate.
What do you do with people whom you control before death? Of what good are they to you while they live?
I use them, or what is left of them after I take charge, as propagandists to help me prepare the minds of others to drift.
You not only fool people into destroying their power to control their own minds, but you use them to help you trap others?
Yes. I let no opportunity get away from me.
Let us come back to the subject of hypnotic rhythm. Tell me more of how this law works. Show me how you use individuals to help you gain control over others. I want to know something of the most effective way you use hypnotic rhythm.
Oh, that is easy. The thing I like best is to fill the minds of people with fear. Once I fill one's mind with fear, I have little trouble causing him to drift until I have entangled him in the web of hypnotic rhythm.
What human fear best serves your purpose?
The fear of death.
Why is the fear of death your favorite weapon?
Because no one knows, and by the very nature of the laws of the universe, no one can prove definitely what happens after death. This uncertainty frightens